On April 15, 2021, the Center for Mental Health Research and Recovery, the MSU Center for Science, Technology, Ethics, and Society, NAMI, Montana, the nonprofit Bring Change to Mind, and the MSU Vice President for Research, Economic Development, and Graduate Education hosted a virtual event titled The Experience and Science of Mental Illness. It featured speakers Kaylin Pick, local artist and mental health advocate, and Dr. Sofia Vinogradov, head of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the University of Minnesota Medical School. Kaylin shared his experiences living with schizophrenia, and Dr. Vinogradov discussed the science behind the disorder. Michelle Hardy, interim program manager at the Center for Mental Health Research and Recovery, introduced the speakers.
And tonight we're delighted to present the fourth in a series called The Experience and Science of Mental Illness with our speakers, artist Kaylin Pick and neuroscientist Dr. Sofia Vinogradov, who is the chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the University of Minnesota Medical School. And this event this evening is sponsored by the MSU Center for Mental Health Research and Recovery, the MSU Center for Science, Technology, Ethics, and Society, and the Montana chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And also sponsoring the event tonight is Bring Change to Mind. This is a nonprofit organization that was founded by Kaylin's aunt, actress Glenn Close. And the mission of Bring Change to Mind is to work toward reducing the stigma and mental illness and discrimination that surrounds mental illness. And we're honored to have them co-sponsor tonight's event. I also want to acknowledge Dr. Jason Carter, the MSU Vice President for Research, Economic Development, and Graduate Education, who has been very supportive of the center. So I'd now like to introduce Dr. Francis Lefcourt. Dr. Lefcourt is a professor of cell biology and neuroscience at Montana State University, and she will tell you a little bit about the origins of the Center for Mental Health Research and Recovery here at MSU.
Thanks, Michelle. So it's a pleasure to welcome all of you here tonight for what will be a really interesting discussion on the brain and how alterations in brain activity affect cognition. So as you know, mental illness affects all of us directly or indirectly, with 1 in 4 people being diagnosed with a disorder. And so in response to this great need in Montana, we at MSU started the Center for Mental Health Research and Recovery with Matt Kuntz, who's the director of NAMI for Montana. And our goal was twofold. One, we sought to develop novel therapeutic strategies for treatment of mental illness. And two, given our large rural state, we wanted to ensure that no matter if you lived in Shelby or Two Dot or Bozeman, that Montanans could reap the benefits of the latest innovations in treatment for mental illness. The center is currently being directed by Dr. Michelle Hardy, who's working closely with our VP for research, Dr. Jason Carter. And I thank both of them for their dedication to the center and to addressing this important problem in Montana. So our goal with this series, The Experience and Science of Mental Illness, is for all of us to learn more about mental illness, both from a patient perspective and from the latest in our scientific understanding and treatment of these disorders. And to that end, we're extremely fortunate and honored to welcome two outstanding speakers tonight, Kaylin Pick and Dr. Sofia Vinogradov. And I'm going to turn it back to Michelle at this point.
Great. Thanks, Francis. Now for just some logistics. Kaylin will speak first about his experiences living with schizoaffective disorder. Dr. Vinogradov will follow by talking about schizophrenia, the neural mechanisms behind the disorder, and describe some of her research. So it's now my pleasure to introduce Kaylin. Kaylin is a local Bozeman artist. He's a staunch advocate for mental health, as well as an ambassador for Bring Change to Mind. And Kaylin has given numerous talks in the national spotlight about his experiences and his recovery process. And he has been courageous in this in sharing his story in public, similar to his mother, Jessie Close, who was our guest this past January. If you missed that event, please visit the center website. We have it recorded and it's posted there. Kaylin is a self-taught artist, and as he shares his story with you, he also will share some of his work. I also encourage you to visit his webpage at kaylinpick.com if you're interested in seeing more. And with that, Kaylin, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you to everyone at MSU for having me. I'll say I'm 39, from Bozeman. I was diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder when I was 19 at McLean Hospital. So that's about 20 years of recovery. And what I really kind of want to do is read and then comment on some sort of what I consider insight into really, I guess, myself and my mental illness, and then give an idea of what my recovery has been like. But I do want to acknowledge that, or my words that I'm speaking are my own. You know, I mean, everyone's got their own experience, and I really want to acknowledge that, out of respect, that I acknowledge that other people have a different experience. Getting better is a hard thing to do, and I believe I'm now able to interpret reality successfully and maintain a pretty good life, I think. And I think a lot of that is because of the care I was afforded early on during that probably 2 years that I was inching up in severity of psychosis. My late grandfather, William Close, said that too much navel gazing will get you nowhere. And I really look to that as being true. I think a real balance of looking inward and outward must be struck. And what I don't want to do is sit here and whine about it. The issue of mental health is a global problem with many facets: social, civil, scientific, chemical, biological, but genetics have been now shown to play a major role. A causal gene has not yet been implicated, as far as I know, but many genes appear to be important, or the so-called smoking guns. I think I was pretty naive about mental health. I mean, I was completely naive and to the point of ignorant, I think, about mental health until I became ill. And I hadn't really looked at my life in a critical, deep way at that point. Some days I held my head up high, and some days I drowned in waters of unfamiliarity. My mind was a place of distrust of others and myself. I felt I couldn't trust my instincts, and I was reminded of this when I opened my mouth to try and give voice to my inner world. That inner world was primarily fantasy during the first years after the onset of my schizoaffective disorder. I've adopted a philosophy of understanding that today I'm a different person than yesterday. And I think that really speaks to change, that change can happen really quickly, or it can happen really gradually over a long period of time. So being aware of that, like, and accepting the change or insight, I guess, when it presents itself. And as far as I can see, there were many factors in why I became ill. But the short of it is that I developed a new reality for myself without really trying to. My mind wanted to go places that I couldn't have conceived of earlier in life, and I had no choice but to experience them, whether they were pleasant fantasies or nightmares. And the drop, I can tell you, into psychosis is a pretty rapid descent. Like I said, I was getting sick for about 2 years, I think, pretty consistently downward spiral. The climb back out is much more difficult. The bottom line is that without our minds, we are nothing, but with our minds, we can be anything. And another kind of concept that I wanted to share is the idea that too much kind of analysis into any kind of critical concept that might occur to you, I think too much kind of pressure on that concept in terms of understanding that concept can cause it to kind of disintegrate. I can cause it to kind of not make sense after too much of this kind of analysis. So my journey to create a healthy mind has not been a simple one. I still have sometimes thoughts that aren't rational. As these thoughts age, they become vague and riddled with absurdity. If I'm not careful, these thoughts can ruin me. And I'm speaking a little bit to grandiosity. I think grandiosity is really at the heart of psychosis. And I think there's a lot to be said for a healthy amount of thought rejection as well as thought acceptance. I have to say that it is painful to remember how I thought and behaved 20 years ago. how I scared my parents and my siblings by losing control, how my eyes told people to back off. It's true that I was in pain, sick, and weak in my mind. That was the case, but now it's in the past. When I first got very sick, talking to me must have been like talking to a brick wall. I was permanently introverted, almost catatonic at times, hunched over and scared. Fear and anxiety coursed through my veins every waking hour, and I lost my mind over and over. So I remember in a little place I was living, losing my mind. And I remember the horrible feeling of that crashing through the floor of support and seeing my whole reality kind of lose its, I lost my grip on it. It's just taken a lot to get it back. And I mean, I feel like now I have a pretty strong place in my mind where I can retreat to when I need to come back to a stable place. And I do have some experience in the research aspect of mental illness. I was involved with a study that started at McLean Hospital and kind of followed me out to Montana, but it had to do with glycine. They found a mutation that supposedly was responsible for the metabolization of glycine. And they thought because my brain was already doing this sort of function or having this function, that maybe it would be actionable and that they could give me glycine to kind of augment the levels in my brain. That was an experience in itself. And I'm sure you'll hear more about that. I think laughing at yourself, for one, has to be one of the most important things that we can do in terms of introspection, I think. And I have this other concept that I like, where it's like the weakest link theory. A person can be the weakest link in a chain. And I'm referring to kind of society or the community that people live in. And it's like, I don't want to be the weakest link. I don't want to let everyone else down by underperforming or struggling, I guess. And I think we should really be careful of not bad mouthing, but making fun of people, for one. You know, at a young age can be damaging. I have it written down here. I say that I've said some pretty stupid things in a public forum before, but I don't care. I'll stand up here all day and I'll talk about this stuff because it's been helpful to me, and I hope that someone else may hear this and feel a little better about themselves, maybe. I have experience with being a patient, a lot of it. I was put into a locked unit up in Helena, and I had to be restrained. And I'm so thankful that that is such a far thing in my past, because that was rock bottom for me. And then perceived persecution is another thing that I think is maybe worth talking about, because when you're talking about psychosis, any little piece of information can be used to kind of advance the untruth of what might be going on in the head. So people who feel that kind of unfounded persecution, you know, that's dangerous, I think. And so I think the more compassion you can put into your own life when dealing with other people, you can't go wrong. I mean, there's a lot of people on the street that have been through some pretty hard stuff. 85%, I think, of people on the street are mentally ill or something like that, something. On one hand, I'm coming at this from someone who's had good treatment and can see that my past is not who I am anymore. I feel almost guilt at that, but I don't think anyone needs to feel guilt for getting help, or at least, you know, asking questions. So I think at this point, I might like to go through a slideshow, I'd like to share some artwork and kind of illustrate, no pun intended, the potential that artwork has for therapy. So this was a sculpture idea I had a long time ago, kind of an image that came to me, not about the Rolling Stones at all, but just kind of this screaming image that maybe it was because I felt I couldn't communicate or something. This is the same thing. This was an outsider art fair in New York. Image I was painting skis and snowboards for a while. And then some of the faces I paint. Something I think that has to do with the reason I paint faces is the way that I kind of can interact with the image. I can interact with the expression on the face. I can change the expression very subtly. And it was became this kind of, you know, almost a conversation. It's a portrait of my brother. It helps me. I think being in front of the canvas or airbrushing or whatever, I think it really allows for good introspection. This is more geometric. This is airbrush, but it's with a piece of photo paper. So I'm doing these facets on either side of a dividing line, like a, you know, trying to keep it pretty symmetrical. But obviously it gets pretty complicated and the symmetry is way off, even though it might appear that way. This one, everything in it is either a perfect circle or a straight line or a segment of. This obviously is not symmetrical. There is no effort to keep it symmetrical. So it's almost this bizarre kind of contrast. And again, landscapes appear from not much in my mind. So in this face, I was having ideas about space. And over on this side, on the right side of it, it's almost these geometric lines. And on the other side, of course, is more complex, almost like it's been through the filter of the mind, you know, information filtering through a mind into something else. So this is interesting that I did this when I was doing a lot of MRIs, and it looks almost like a sort of a field, like a magnetic field or something. I don't know, around a person is kind of serene, I think. This was painted 10 years ago, I think, at this point. So it's a little premonition, maybe, of some kind. And then, of course, again, this duality, this kind of dual field kind of happening behind a face, and I don't know what that has to do with, but vision. This is depicting vision literally as I can. That's a self-portrait. Basically, that's the imagery I have going on in my mind. So a lot of these are not from any reference. They're just kind of dreamscapes. This is Emerald Creek. This is concentric. I'm just working in these little areas formed by concentric circles throughout the whole thing. This is affecting the ether. I was thinking how easy it was to kind of just affect what was around me. And this is sort of a depiction of that. I mean, that's essentially my artwork. But yeah, I mean, I just wanted to maybe share a little bit because I know how amazing it is, the similarities that can happen surrounding psychosis with sort of the thematic stuff and crazy ideas, that this idea of universal thought, I think. That's my presentation, and thank you very much for having me.
Thanks, Palin. I want to go ahead and ask a couple of questions of you that came in. The first, what would be your advice to us on how to approach and talk to persons who experience these types of struggles that you have?
Well, that's a hard one. I know. I would say there's a lot of fear flying around. I know that when I was most psychotic, I was very, very scared. And so I kind of tried to understand that people who might be going through a psychotic event or something like that, it's like they're more scared of you than you are of them. So it's almost like a wild animal. I would show patience. Patience is a huge thing. Careful of judgment. It's a tough one, but I think patience is a big part of it.
I have another question here. Do you see any way that technology could have helped you to better cope, or maybe a digital companion in the form of a mental health smartphone application to help in real time?
Yeah, I mean, I think having some sense of organization and self-care and stuff like that is pretty important. And so, yeah, I mean, I could see that helping. I don't know if it would have helped me when I was struggling most, but yeah, I could see it being helpful.
Throughout your recovery and balance, do you find it is professional therapy, medication, or your own artwork that has helped you stay in balance?
I'm going to say medication and artwork. Yeah. and patience with myself too. The kind of changes that I wanted to see in myself didn't happen overnight. So it's kind of counterintuitive, but.
Can you say something more about the role of your art in recovery?
I don't know. I mean, I can't explain it any other way than like, it's just the happiest place that I can think of for myself is in front of a canvas painting. And it's kind of always been that way my whole life. But I think having insight into my own humanity happens easiest when I'm doing that. It's almost like I can concentrate without really concentrating.
Thank you. That was a really insightful and articulate kind of a description that you've given of your experiences. It's really, really terrific to hear someone so you know, who introspects so well. I'm curious, you know, you mentioned those first 2 years, you felt like you were heading into psychosis, but you hadn't maybe quite gotten there yet. Mm-hmm. But you felt in retrospect, it seemed things were accumulating. In retrospect, what would you say were the hallmark signs that were starting to happen? What do you wish you or others had picked up on earlier?
I don't know. I can't really say. I don't know. It's almost like I've instantly had something to prove when I lost my mind. And so maybe it would be something along the lines of the kind of bizarre behavior I might have been exhibiting. I wish someone had kind of headed that off or brought that up to me when I was doing it, you know, just literally asked me, you know, why are you behaving like that? And I think it probably did happen. But so, yeah, I don't know. So that's a hard question.
Well, thanks.
When you were first actively diagnosed, how did your perception affect your ability to trust and understand medical and other mental health professionals? Yeah. How could this process have been improved on the medical professional side?
The medical professional side, I saw some pretty good doctors. So I really don't have any bones to pick with them, or I think they were top of the heap. I, for a long time, had trouble hearing other people, I think. I never really had a doctor that I connected with to the point of feeling really cured. It's just like an ongoing thing, so it's kind of hard to say.
Well, thanks, Kaylin. That was really inspiring to hear you talk about your story. And I want to turn the stage back over to Dr. Lefcourt, and she will introduce Dr. Vinogradov to you. Francis?
Okay, thanks, Michelle. First off, Kaylin, I just really feel honored and privileged to have been able to listen to you. I can imagine it's not easy going back to a dark place, but it's really a service for all of us to know more about your experience and really helpful. So thank you very much. I'm really grateful to you for having the courage.
Okay.
Thank you. So now it's my great pleasure to introduce Sofia Vinogradov. I first met her in 2016 when she gracefully accepted our invitation to be on our center's scientific advisory board. And she joined us for a few days for a small conference we put together in Big Sky. And there she described to us the brilliant work she was doing to enhance cognitive function in psychiatric illness, and I followed her work with great interest ever since. So Sofia earned her MD from Wayne State in 1983. She then went on to do her residency in psychiatry at Stanford. She then worked at the VA Center in Palo Alto as a psychiatrist until 1989, when she moved to UCSF and the San Francisco Veterans Affairs Medical Clinic. And she was there until 2016, when she moved to the University of Minnesota Medical School to become the head of their Department of Psychiatry. And she's won numerous awards for her teaching and for her research, including the NAMI National Scientific Research Award. And she's has over 180 publications. So her research interest is in translational clinical neuroscience, with a major focus on understanding cognitive dysfunction in schizophrenia. And using computerized cognitive training coupled with real-time brain imaging methods, her goal is to induce changes in circuit activity that will improve cognitive function. And moreover, she's applying these approaches to study brain activity in adolescents who are in sort of early stages of psychosis, with the ultimate goal being to prevent further progression of their illness. So her work has garnered much attention and promise for trying to mitigate cognitive dysfunction that accompanies schizophrenia, and including she made a presentation at the White House in a conference on this topic. And so please join me in welcoming Sophia virtually, I wish it were in person, to Montana once again.
Thank you, Frances, and thank you for that very kind introduction. That was a lot of big scientific words, and I'm going to try and explain some of those terms as I tell you about what I see as three major changes happening in the field of psychiatry that are really opening up new models of how we can offer mental health treatment to do exactly what Kaelin has told us about his story, which is to promote recovery. One of the words that Kaelin has used that I'm assuming many of you are familiar with, but I'd like to describe for in more detail for a minute, is the word psychosis. And psychosis is just a general term that means loss of touch with reality. And that loss of touch with reality can express itself in different ways for different people. So in some people, it can mean they have hallucinations. They hear or see things that aren't really there. For other people, they can experience delusions. Kaelin mentioned the word grandiosity. People can start to think they are super important or have super fantastic abilities or powers. There can also be delusional thinking of a paranoid nature or of some bizarre conspiracy that is happening that the person might be involved in. Psychosis can be characterized by disorganized behavior, where the behavior just doesn't make sense. And Kaelin, you alluded a little bit to that as well, where the behavior just seems bizarre and why is this person reacting this way? So psychosis is a very general term. It means when the person is no longer responding adaptively or appropriately to their environment, they're responding to an internal reality, which is not a reality that the rest of us share. And it can be seen in different psychiatric disorders. Schizophrenia is a disorder where there often is psychosis. There's periods of psychosis. Schizoaffective disorder is another one, as Kaelin has described to us. We can see psychosis in certain severe cases of depression or bipolar illness. We can see psychosis induced by abuse of certain drugs and so forth. But one of the things that we've realized is that we now have these really interesting and powerful scientific tools to delve deeper into what is happening in the brain when someone experiences psychosis. And these new tools and these new understandings have led to some of the changes that I'd like to tell you about today. So the first thing I want to share with you that we now understand in, I would say, in 2021 quite well is that psychiatric illnesses are what we call developmental disorders. A developmental disorder means it's something that occurs at some point as a human being is developing and will have a course to it. It will change over time as the person changes and develops over time. And indeed, I think most of us who think about these issues would argue that all psychiatric illnesses have a developmental component. Kaelin mentioned to us the genetic component. This means that in many cases, the person is born carrying some genes that may place him or her at increased risk or as a more vulnerable person for the development of psychiatric symptoms. And then as this person goes through childhood, adolescence, early adulthood, other things are happening to them developmentally, both in terms of their own biology, but also in terms of the culture and society in which they find themselves and the experiences they're having that can contribute to whether or not psychiatric illness will occur. And in fact, Kaelin mentioned those as well. So some of the things that can happen developmentally that increase the risk for psychosis are, even before the person is born, was their mother malnourished? Did she have infections? Did she have diabetes? When those things occur, and in particular when they occur in someone who might have some genetic predisposition, it increases the risk for the person later developing a psychosis illness. During early childhood, bullying, trauma, immigrating to a new country and culture, those increase someone's risk for developing psychosis. Living in an urban environment, living in an environment where there's higher access to drugs, particularly high THC cannabis use, can contribute to the development of psychosis. And then in adolescence, stressors, loss, trauma, again, can contribute. So this is this notion that over time, different things are happening developmentally that increase this risk for developing these symptoms. And so the conclusion, and again, this is something which is seems intuitive, but it really took us maybe the last 10 years to get really honed in on, is that we have to practice early detection and early intervention. In fact, ideally, we would get better and better at identifying when someone is entering a high-risk state, usually as an adolescent or young adult, and we would intervene then. And Kaylin, that's why I asked you that question. Like, if looking back, hindsight being 2020, if someone had been able to identify some of these high-risk signs early before the first full-blown set of psychosis symptoms, what do you wish they would have noticed? And it's also, by the way, Kaylin, really common that people just don't remember super well what was going on at that time. I can tell you that typically what we see, because now we're getting better and better at this early detection and intervention, is withdrawal from friends, withdrawal from school or usual activities, beginning to sort of fail activities that they used to do quite well, sports, school, other activities, withdrawing from family, appearing depressed, appearing internally preoccupied, sometimes again doing behaviors that don't make any sense, as Kaylin mentioned. So we are getting better, but I think we still have a long way to go, not just as professionals, but as society, for really having a high index of sensitivity to noticing when a young person is entering into this high-risk state and intervening with patience and compassion, and not with judgment, but with patience and compassion, really important. So the reason it is so important to do this early detection intervention, I just want to point out to you here, this is called disability life years for different diseases and disorders by age. So over here is the different age that a person can have, less than 5, 5 to 9, 10 to 14, 15 to 19, and so forth, all the way up to more than 80. And this is the cumulative disability life years. So this is just how much disability is accumulating in the U.S. This is not worldwide. In the U.S., over time due to different disorders. And if you look, you'll see that these orange dots here, this orange line curve here, shows cumulative disability occurring in the United States due to mental and behavioral disorders. And you'll see that particularly during the key years when people are in the prime of life, so we're talking between ages 15 here and up into the late 50s, mental and behavioral disorders far outstrip other kinds of disorders, such as musculoskeletal disorders, diabetes, respiratory disease, cardiovascular disorders in these prime years of life. So if we're looking to keep people from being disabled and from not really being able to live life to the fullest in these prime years of their life, it's mental and behavioral disorders which should be our targets. And again, that begins to argue for trying to intervene young, early, adolescence, before this kind of, again, sort of tragic onset of disability can occur. I'm going to just show a couple of photos. Sometimes I show a little vignette of a story of a man who now lives homeless on the streets of San Francisco, a man named John Rutledge. And he has refused treatment. He's been treatment resistant. And, you know, again, Kaylin noted that many homeless people have serious mental illness. He does have schizophrenia. If you saw him on the streets of San Francisco now, he basically talks to himself. He takes care of pigeons. He feels that the pigeons are tiny wizards that have a special message for him. He searches through garbage cans. If you were to see him on the streets of San Francisco, you know, you'd certainly say, oh, you know, this is what a terrible mental illness this man has. You might be a little bit frightened of his behavior. You might forget that before he had this illness, he was a young man. He was a young professional. He made documentaries, who actually had a family and had many aspirations. He did at this point in life begin to show some of those early signs I've been talking about. In his case, it was beginning to feel a little bit increasingly suspicious of people. He felt that maybe people were tracking him because of the documentaries he was working on, but he didn't have any frank loss of touch with reality. And it's sometimes easy to remember that this young man prior to that had been a child, and a child who didn't show any signs of mental illness, except, again, some research would indicate perhaps some very, how would I call them, nuanced signs of perhaps just being a little shyer than other kids, a little bit more awkward socially, perhaps a little bit of difficulty kind of responding kind of quickly in social kinds of settings, but certainly not signs of mental illness, just very soft findings, if you will, in retrospect, which have been observed in retrospect. And in fact, there's a famous study that was done where a researcher took home movies, and this was in the days when there were home movies, and that some of the home movies, the children in the home movie, one of the children grew up to have schizophrenia, and in the other home movies, none of that didn't happen to any of the children. And she showed these home movies to experts, and she said, look at these home movies and see if you can tell me which is the child which will grow up later to have schizophrenia. And with uncanny accuracy, expert researchers could identify that child. And when asked what it was, they said it was very subtle findings of some just awkwardness around social interactions, a little bit of motor or muscular awkwardness and the like. Again, nothing at the time that you would have said is indicative of a serious mental illness. So the point I've been trying to make here, this first point, is that we have to think about psychiatric illnesses as having this developmental course, this developmental trajectory over time, where someone starts out without any symptoms, may start to maybe have some slight changes, and then, of course, things get more full-blown. There's the full-blown psychosis. We make a diagnosis. And then, unfortunately, in some cases, some people can refuse treatment or be treatment-resistant, and they can become more ill. The other thing we know in 2021 is that the brain changes, the changes in the brain that we know are associated with psychosis are happening before that first full-blown diagnosis. Again, speaking to the need to really get better and better at intervening here and not waiting till here. The second kind of take-home message I'd like to give you today, which is now accepted knowledge, is that psychiatric illnesses are disorders of how the brain processes information. And of course, the conclusion that we come from that is new treatments have to focus on improving how the brain processes information. But what do I mean exactly by this? And how is this different from neurologic disorders like stroke or multiple sclerosis? Well, it's a really interesting distinction. I would say, to keep it simple, that in neurologic disorders, which are also brain disorders, we can localize very specifically the place in the brain where something has gone wrong. In a stroke, we can do an MRI and we can say it's this specific region of the brain that, you know, again, where the blood flow got blocked and that part of the brain is now dying. And that's the stroke. In multiple sclerosis, we can take imaging of the brain and we can see the multiple sclerosis lesions scattered in different parts of the brain. And we can say that's what's causing these symptoms. In psychiatric illnesses, we can't take a picture of the brain and localize the issue to a specific brain area. What we see instead when we do very subtle and sophisticated brain imaging is that in psychiatric illnesses, the brain is just processing information slightly differently from how someone who doesn't have those symptoms is processing it. The brain is an information processing organ, and I think of it almost like it has to be finely tuned. All the circuits have to be working properly together. Well, in psychiatric illnesses, it's as if just a few of the circuits are just a little bit off. So, you know, not all the, I don't know, what might you have? You might have a switch, you know, for all the lights in the house to go on at the same time. Well, in psychiatric illnesses, the timing of those switches are off a little bit. And again, this has implications now that we know this and understand it for thinking about how to come up with new treatments. The brain is made up of nerve cells called neurons, and these neurons are talking to each other through electrical impulses, and that's forming these circuits. And as these circuits get activated, that's how we process information from the world. It's how we see, it's how we hear, it's how we remember things, it's how we take information that we is occurring right now and make sense of it, and then decide how we want to act appropriately. As Kaylin noted, when you have those symptoms where you feel like you are losing your mind, literally what is happening is these connections aren't happening properly anymore. So the brain is not taking information in correctly from the outside world, and it's processing that information, it's connecting it in all sorts of, in a sense, maladaptive ways, ways that don't really make sense and don't help the person to respond appropriately to what's happening around them. Just a couple of examples of this idea that psychiatric illnesses are disorders of how the brain processes information. One thing we now know is that in people who have depression, the brain information processing circuits are actually biased towards overprocessing negative information. It's as if the brain networks preferentially focus on negative information and interpret information negatively, even when the information is neutral. And we have lots of experimental evidence to show that that's the case. And it's doing this at a level below awareness. This is not conscious. This is not something, it's not like the person is gets up in the morning and says, oh, I'm going to only focus on negative information today. Their brain is actually taking in information that way, in that biased way. In psychotic illness, the brain has abnormalities in how it's processing perceptions of the world. So it's not taking in auditory information quite right. It's not taking in visual information quite right. And of course, that is resulting in an altered sense of reality. So as I've said before, and again, if you remember nothing else from tonight, I hope you will remember that psychiatric illnesses are brain information processing disorders. The important thing to remember in terms of beginning to think about new treatments is that brain information processing is plastic. And we use the term plastic to mean it's changeable, it's malleable, it's not rigid. And there's a very famous study, it's about 20 years old now, where the scientists studied taxi drivers in London. To become a taxi driver, you have to learn this map. You have to learn how to navigate this map during rush hour and construction. You've got your taxi car here, and they have a whole written set of rules and navigation that they have to learn. And they spend about 2 years doing it to get this certification. And what the researchers showed is that over this two-year period, those who became taxi drivers showed actual change in their brain, in a part of the brain called the hippocampus, showing that the brain is changing over time, and especially as it's processing new information. In this case, the taxi drivers had to process new information about navigation and driving the taxis through these complicated streets, and that actually changed the structure of their brain. Well, if we can improve brain information processing in people with psychiatric symptoms, and if the brain can then change, as we have lots of evidence to now show that it does, then we should be able to help people have a better quality of life. So the idea is we would start by targeting brain information processing, helping the brain do it more quickly and more accurately. This should help the brain's cognitive functioning. You heard Francis use the word cognitive. This is a fancy word for thinking skills, and it can also include, related to it, social and emotional responses. So again, as the brain processes information better, this means we should be able to pay better attention, to be better at learning and memory, to be more accurate in our social and emotional responses. As an example, we know that people who have certain psychosis illnesses don't actually process social information coming in the way people who don't have those illnesses do. So for example, most of us, when we're looking at a face for the first time, we start by looking at the eyes and then we scan the rest of the face. And our brain puts all that information together and then recognizes the face. And people with schizophrenia don't start by scanning the eyes. Their brain kind of is more disjointed and they're looking at different parts of the face. Again, this is below the level of awareness. So the brain's not taking in that facial information in a nice, cohesive, coherent way. It's all disjointed. And of course, you can see how if the brain is not getting the correct information about what's going on in someone's face, it's going to make it hard for that person who has schizophrenia to have an appropriate social emotional response. Anyway, so the idea is if we can make those things better, it's in the sense it's the building blocks for all the things that allow us to have satisfying life functions, work, social mood, motivation, and so forth. So that's been the basis certainly of my research. And I'm going to show you an example of how we help a brain learn to process information better. This is a brain training exercise. And it's focused on the hearing system. in that exercise, what the person has to do is listen to the sounds. Are they sweeping up or are they sweeping down? Remember them and then indicate an up arrow or a down arrow. This is a simple training exercise to help the auditory system, or what we call the hearing system, process information more accurately. And this sound may seem very simple to you, but for people with schizophrenia, this is not super easy. Their brain is having trouble with that auditory information. And again, there's a lot of research on that. And so we did a study in which we did this auditory training in young people who were in their first few years of having a schizophrenia or a schizophrenia-related diagnosis. And this is what we saw. AT stands for auditory training. CG stands for computer games. We had a control group, a group who did not do the auditory training but did computer games, just so we had two groups of people who are doing activities on the computer. And we measured their symptoms. These were all young people with first few years of schizophrenia. So these are their symptom ratings. And of course, fewer symptoms, lower is better. And this is where their symptom ratings started at baseline. Both groups were the same. And you can see over time, the group that is getting training of their auditory system to make their auditory system process information more accurately, their symptom levels are going down over time. And when we did a 6-month follow-up, their levels had significantly dropped. Whereas the computer games control group, they're showing a little improvement while they're in the study, but when we bring them back 6 months later, they're back up to where they started. People got a lot of attention in the study, so we think everyone benefited from that attention of being in the study, but it was the actual brain training exercises group that continued to show symptom improvement, which is interesting, right? Because how would training the brain to become better at processing auditory information allow someone's symptoms, like hallucinations and delusions and so forth, to get better? Well, that's an interesting question, and we've been doing research to understand why that is, but it does seem to be the case. It's, again, you've gotten the information processing networks in the brain to work more accurately, and that is helping the symptoms resolve over time. Another thing, this is a lot of data, so I'm only going to go very briefly into it, but I want to emphasize that we also saw that in people who did the auditory training, we saw growth in their brain tissue, somewhat similarly to what they saw with the taxi drivers, you know, 20 years ago. This work was done by Ian Ramsey, a colleague of mine. And what you see here in red is the group that got the auditory training. Here we have labeled them as targeted cognitive training, but it's the same kind of training of the auditory system. This is the group that got the computer games. This is their change in cognition. So this is whether their thinking skills got better. This is kind of after this, they did the training compared to before. So this is a change score. This is the change in the volume of their thalamus. This is a part of the brain that is important for transmitting perceptual information, like auditory information. And what you can see is that the group that got the training in red, those who showed most changes in their thinking skills as they went through the training were the group that showed most changes in this brain volume area compared to the computer games control group, where we saw a different pattern. So I think, again, the main take-home message I'd like you to know here is that we see this brain plasticity. We see this capacity for the brain to change and grow and adapt and develop new information processing networks in a healthier way in people who are in these early phases of psychotic illness. And that is very promising. That's a new way of thinking about treatment, a new way of thinking about recovery, a new way of thinking about offering people the chance to get their brains healthy again in ways that go beyond therapy and medication, which are, of course, also extremely important. So our idea is that these kinds of approaches, when taken all together, might allow us to bend the curve of this developmental trajectory and promote recovery. So the idea is that we can offer people brain training exercises and we can bend that curve around the time of diagnosis and get people's symptoms to essentially be resolved. The third and final point that I would like to leave you with is that I very, very firmly believe, and I know that the center there at Montana State believes this also, this is one of their core principles, is that the practice of psychiatry must get closer to modern neuroscience discoveries. This has been a super exciting time for learning about the brain in the last two decades, and we need to figure out ways that we can use new tools from neuroscience to better understand what is happening in the brain during psychiatric illness, and then, of course, how to help people have the kinds of recoveries that Kaylin has been describing to us. And we believe some of our work has been thinking about how can new tools from neuroscience help us tailor personalized understanding of what's happening in the brain for each individual and then personalized treatments. So we've been working on some approaches in which we are using some digital methods. This could be on an iPad or an iPhone to do certain kinds of measures of the brain, including how the brain might be processing auditory information or visual information or social emotional information. This allows us to get some different kinds of data or actual measures. Those measures help us to start to think about what should we be personalizing for a given individual? What should we be focusing on in terms of their treatment? We might do some additional measures such as brain scanning, different kinds of, again, electroencephalography, kind of this, in a sense, brain wave measures. We put together all of this information. We start to hopefully be able to help make more precise recommendations on whether psychotherapy is going to be helpful, whether brain training exercises, whether medications, or some combination that is personalized to the given profile of a given individual. And then, of course, as people go through the treatments, we can continue to collect information if they wish. They can share information with us, and we can, in a sense, close this loop and see if we're having the goals we want to have of helping people get to the kinds of lives they want to have. And we believe that this kind of personalized information that is grounded in the discoveries of neuroscience will support joint decision making, which we think is so important. The decisions that need to be made when someone is working on their recovery and a mental illness have to come from that person, not from the doctor. But more information we feel is better as people make those decisions. And ultimately, this increases each individual's ability to autonomously make the right decisions for them and their families. So what next? The things I've been working on and I'm interested in, I'd like to participate in creating the next generation learning model to help people who are in training to become mental health professionals understand and treat mental illness in these new kinds of ways. I'm a big advocate for research that investigates the underlying neuroscience of mental illnesses, as I know the center there at Montana State is focusing on. And finally, of course, I think the work that you all are doing, those of you who are here advocating, such as you, Kaylin, is we need to focus on creating a world of early detection and early intervention so that all individuals can achieve mental well-being and contribute their many gifts to us. And I'd like to end with this slide, which reminds us of the many individuals who have faced the challenges of mental illness and made incredible gifts to all of us. And this is actually a dear cousin of mine, and this is actually a young man at the University of Minnesota who participated in a research study many years ago of a pharmacology intervention and had an unfortunate outcome, but was well-known and well-loved in the community. So thank you for your attention. I will make a mention that this work that I've presented to you is actually, it's not just me. Many people have participated over the years, and we have a whole team. And of course, I want to thank those who have participated in our research and their families for supporting it. And thank you for your attention.
Thanks, Sophia. That was really great. And we really appreciate your insights and all of the work that you do, and certainly for taking the time out to talk to everybody this evening. We really appreciate that.
Dr. Vinogradov, so great to have you back. I just want to say thank you for your work and actually some of the insights that you've been doing. One of the things that came out of our center was the Precision Mental Health Initiative in the Commander John Scott Hannon Act. That's the new Precision Mental Health Initiative in the VA. And it wouldn't have happened without you and that whole group coming to Big Sky and helping train us so much. So it was actually named after a Montana veteran that was a dear friend. So
that's fantastic. I'm so glad to hear that that has come to fruition. Fabulous.
My question, as someone that works with in NAMI and advocating and talking about this, do you think we should start consider calling these like brain information processing conditions or something more specific and helpful? Because people get turned off from mental illness and mental health.
If it wasn't such a mouthful, I'd say yes. It is a mouthful, but it is also so much more accurate. The term like mental illness, mental disorder, it's got so much like stigma associated with it. that is always what is my concern. Whereas really these are issues related to how the brain is processing information. And most people get that intuitively. It's just such a mouthful to say. Just as another example, so you may have heard of this, but you know, schizophrenia, which I think is like a terrible name for an illness. It's so heterogeneous. But anyway, there's a very famous researcher who has proposed that it be renamed salience detection disorder. Because in schizophrenia, and I think you kind of alluded to this, Kaylin, one of the things that happens is the brain's ability to figure out what is salient and what is not. In other words, what is important information in the environment and what is not important information in the environment has gone off track. And it's really a disorder of salience detection. So when someone has psychosis, they begin to think that random events are salient or connected in salient ways. And then, of course, that causes all sorts of difficulties. So some years ago, he said, you know, this really should be called salience detection disorder. And many of us went, yeah, you're exactly right. And you're never going to get anyone. No one's ever going to take that on. And it's true because we still use the term schizophrenia. So I would love to see us come up with a better way of naming what's actually happening.
Sophia, do you think that motor skills will end up being a part of the screening process for risk of mental illness in youth?
You know, that's a super interesting question. There's no doubt that motor skills, certain subtle motor system findings seem to indicate increased risk. They're pretty nonspecific, but I suspect what will end up happening is as we get better and better at knowing how to screen, they'll just be one of the things we screen for, and then it would be in combination with other factors that may or may not be showing up, and it's almost like someone would get a total score. I don't know if you've ever done any of these cardiovascular risk profiles, right? It's do you smoke, but it's not just if you smoke. It's are you overweight, but it's not just if you're overweight. It's all these different things you have to answer, and then they weight them and put them together in an algorithm. I think it'll end up being something similar.
I'm kind of constantly struck by the fact that there are other psychiatric conditions that seem to have perturbations of salience representations. Mm-hmm. Why are there so many things that from DSM perspective are very different conditions, but they often come back to perturbed salience?
Are you talking about like salience, or say, for example, drug addiction, suddenly drugs become extremely salient to the addicted person, or?
In addiction, it could be that it could be related, right? It could be that that's part of the rewards, a perturbation of reward processing. And reward is part of salience, but also like in autism, like, you know, there are models of autism where the salience map is wrong, or it's drawing attention to the wrong features in the visual scene,
right?
Which seems very similar in some ways to what schizophrenics show.
Right. Yeah, I would say, I haven't thought about autism. Just talking off the top of my head, I would say that one of the main differences is that autism, as you say, the mapping is wrong, and there's certain features of the environment which are over highly weighted, such as certain perhaps visual features or tactile features. Whereas what seems to happen in psychosis is that the ability to filter out what is appropriately salient from what, it's not like one set is overweighted. It's more like the ability to make the distinctions between what should be salient at a given moment in time and what should not is perturbed. And so you start having several things that are unrelated become, because they're all being experienced as salient, somehow then the brain starts to create a narrative around them. So like, for example, you and I, if a plane goes overhead right now, our brains will filter that out. We know in schizophrenia that doesn't get filtered out. The actual neural mapping of that auditory information is abnormal. And so the brain starts to go, huh, well, the plane driving by and the voice on the screen, they're somehow connected. So she's not just giving a talk right now. There's someone in the plane beaming a message down to her that's supposed to be a special message for me. And why would that be? I've got to figure that one out.
That makes sense. Maybe in some ways, salience is at the heart of so many different life critical behaviors that any perturbations become devastating, potentially.
Absolutely.
And so it's just that they're all very different underlying causes, but we recognize them so readily when it's a salience deficit.
I think that's very insightful. And I think what's different in the different flavors that show up in different diagnoses is you know, what is the nature of the salience distortion? And then how is it tied to an affective reaction? Is it tied to a cognitive reaction? Is it tied to reward systems? But that's definitely worth thinking more and thinking about how to model that. Yeah.
You are tuned to KGVM Bozeman.
Dr. Vinogradoff, in the future, I aspire to provide psychiatric care to homeless and other vulnerable populations. How can we make mental health treatment more accessible to these groups of people?
That is such a wonderful and at some level heartbreaking question. We've been talking about it in my department, so thinking what's ahead, and you undoubtedly know, probably what's ahead is a mental health pandemic following the COVID pandemic. There's just an article out in The Lancet earlier this week. So a significant portion of people who have tested positive for COVID when followed 6 months later, this is a medical records review, are showing up with mental health diagnoses or mental health complaint within the next 6 months. Even before COVID, right, we had a mental health treatment crisis, particularly for people who are disadvantaged in our societies. And it's only going to get worse now with the effects, the actual effects. I'm talking about actual physiologic effects of this virus on the brain. And don't even think about the social and emotional and economic effects it's had, which is, of course, rough on people who already might have had pre-existing conditions. So I think there's going to be a mental health pandemic in the coming years. I think we need to obviously train more professionals. This whole issue of how do we get the help where it's most needed to the populations who need it most, you know, such as the homeless, such as, again, those who come from disadvantaged backgrounds. It's such a huge social justice issue. I don't know how to call it. It's not a medical issue. It's a social justice issue. So all I can say is where my mind has been with it this week, because I've been thinking about this, is do we need to move to models? Well, it's also related to our system of reimbursement and our medical system, which is so broken, it probably can't be repaired. I'm sorry, I don't mean to be on a soapbox here. But where I'm going with it, I'm thinking maybe we have to come up with systems where we train paraprofessionals to be able to be involved in outreach, say, with the homeless and do those first levels of screening and connection, some of the compassion and patience that Kaylin was mentioning to get people ready to be engaged in treatment. I don't know. I wish I had an answer for that.
I think we all wish you had an answer for that. Kaylin, I've always wanted to know more about the individual human side of afflictions like these. However, I am always afraid that any questions I direct at someone with such an affliction would come off as offensive or prying. How can I show genuine curiosity without making someone feel like an exhibit?
Maybe the decision would be the persons that you're talking to. I don't think you immediately need to feel like you're bringing something up that's kind of sensitive in that way. Large part of like normalization is thinking about things, being able to kind of break through that barrier, I guess. I don't know if that makes any sense at all.
Sophia, I have another question for you. Where might someone who needs treatment get access to this kind of brain training? Is this just being done in the Minnesota area in your program, or are there other avenues in other states?
There are several centers who are doing research in this area. In terms of having it available as just a part of routine care, that's not at all the norm yet. In New York State, because there's been a very prominent researcher and advocate there, she's done a pretty good job of having, there they call it cognitive remediation, offered pretty widely in different clinics and certainly different treatment centers. But most places it's not, and that's because of reimbursement issues. At this point, you know, brain training exercises are not reimbursed, and clinicians are not trained in how to do this. I would say if there's some interest in approaching this as a research participant, you could get in touch with me. And we've got a project that's going on entirely remotely, depending on, again, I'm assuming you're from Montana, so I don't know of any such projects going on right now in Montana. But I can tell you that our hope is to advocate for this being something that would be a reimbursed treatment that would be offered just as part of what people could select as their care options. And there's some suggestion that we might be heading in that direction because the consensus statement from the American Psychiatric Association came out recently and said this kind of treatment should be part of what is offered, at least in schizophrenia. It's just not now.
Is there any connection or higher percentage of autism related to schizophrenia?
We actually wrote a whole research proposal around this question. So the official answer is no, they're not supposed to be any relationship between the two clinically. The real answer, when you start to do a detailed examination of clinics in which people with autism are treated, or in clinics where people with early psychosis are treated, such as ours, you will find higher rates than expected. So in autism clinics, you will, especially if you follow the individuals through their adolescent years, you will find higher rates than expected of psychosis symptoms. And in our early psychosis program, where we're following teenagers and young adults who are showing the first signs of psychosis, we find higher than expected rates of a history of autism spectrum disorder. And then, of course, there are, Kaylin mentioned, you know, the groups of genes. There are overlaps in some of the genes that show up as risk genes in autism and risk genes for psychosis. So it's probable that some of the factors that place a brain at risk have some overlaps in some individuals, but it's not a perfect 100% overlap, and there's a lot of differences. Autism is very heterogeneous. There are many different forms of autism spectrum disorders, and the same thing with schizophrenia and psychosis. There's many different forms of those disorders, and we're not very good yet at distinguishing the subforms or the subgroups.
Sophia, two questions, actually. One is, from a systems level perspective, what would you think is the best strategy for early detection of psychosis and how that might be implemented on a systems level perspective?
Some places have really done a lot of work investigating how do you help people get more sophisticated at identifying those early warning signs. And there's a group, it was in Portland, Maine, which is a smallish community, so they could really pull everyone together and do this. And they actually went on a public education campaign, and they did radio spots, and they did billboards, and they did education of teachers, especially like high school teachers when people are in that high-risk period, parents groups. And they really basically just said, here are the things to watch out for. You know, if you notice a young person who seems very internally preoccupied, who seems as if they're hearing something inside their head, that's not normal teenage behavior. If they start to get very socially withdrawn, if they start to show an interest in kind of bizarre ideas or spend excessive amounts of time ruminating over certain unusual kinds of trying to put things together in ways. Now, of course, we know that could be adolescence. Adolescents go through a lot of weird things and get into a lot of weird phases. But if it's persisting and they're no longer seeing friends and their sleep-wake cycles have changed and their schoolwork is starting to be affected, then that merits more attention. So they did this public health campaign, and they've been quite successful in really raising just the awareness, just like we're trying to raise the awareness right through public health campaigns around self-injury and suicide, risk for suicidal ideation. So I think it can be done as through public awareness. There's been some really interesting conversations. It's not gone anywhere, that it would be possible to do some of this also through machine learning algorithms applied to social media and other sort of online fingerprints, because it does seem to be that as young people move into these pre-psychosis stages, some of the way they're interacting with online media is changing and, again, becoming a little bit more bizarre and hyper-focused in certain unusual areas. And so there's some of these characteristic fingerprints, and there's some research going on that. And one idea is that when the machine learning algorithm picks that up, a pop-up ad shows up with a, take this quiz, are you experiencing this, connecting them to, you know, further hotline or so. So some of the more creative things that I know of. Honestly, I think there's a huge amount of work just to be done within communities, educating the frontline, the people who are most likely to see this behavior and be in a position to notice it, which is teachers and school counselors.
You're focused more on the brain processing distortions and the science behind that. And can you bring us into how the effective, the emotional states might affect that processing that's going on?
Well, the answer to that is they affect it 100%. The brain is not just a thinking part and emotion part. The two are constantly talking to each other. And then, as we were talking about earlier, it's also the reward and motivation process. So, you know, the brain has these big circuits are involved in motivation, reward, social and emotional processing, cognition, thinking, learning, memory. And all of those are talking to each other constantly and also can be affected. Different of those can be affected in different ways in different individuals. So you're absolutely right. We can't separate out the social and emotional state from everything else, which is why people do better adhering to a cognitive training or a brain training program and benefiting from it when they are a positive coach working with them on it, who's making them feel good about it. And we've also been doing some studies with a coaching app, which, of course, you can now do, so you can do it more remotely. And they now have a community of other young people with schizophrenia who are also doing the training and therapy. And they're all coaching, kind of cheering each other on and posting likes and letting each other know when they've successfully done a module of their treatment. And now you create this whole social network, which feeds into positive social and emotional well-being and supports them in doing these other things. So absolutely, you have to take it all into account.
I want to thank Sophia and Kaylin for sharing their evening with us. We really appreciate it.
You have just heard a virtual event recorded on April 15th, 2021, titled The Experience and Science of Mental Illness. It featured speakers Kaylin Pick, local artist and mental health advocate, and Dr. Sofia Vinogradov, head of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the University of Minnesota Medical School. It was hosted by the Center for Mental Health Research and Recovery, the MSU Center for Science, Technology, Ethics, and Society, NAMI Montana, the nonprofit Bring Change to Mind, and the MSU Vice President for Research, Economic Development, and Graduate Education. You can find out more by going to the Center for Mental Health Research and Recovery's website, www.montana.edu/CMHRR/. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, produced by Joy LaClaire for broadcast and archiving on Gallatin Valley Community Radio, KGVM Bozeman.